many people didn't expect them to happen at all. They had already been delayed twice. The fact that they actually happened, I think that's a triumph.
Afghan voters get another chance to cast ballots. It's Monday, October 22nd. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Australia feels a political shift. An imprisoned Vietnamese blogger finds freedom in the United States. Women carve new careers in Pakistan, slowing illegal animal trade and carbon-hungry plants. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Parliamentary elections in Afghanistan were extended to a second day Sunday, giving people who were not able to cast a ballot Saturday another opportunity. Election officials say 3 million people voted Saturday, but there were challenges, including polling stations that never opened and technical problems with voting equipment. At least 15 people were killed in attacks on voters and polling stations and scores of people injured. The Taliban had issued repeated warnings they would attack polling stations and all election-related activity. The threats, however, were not enough to keep registered voters home. The final results will not be known for weeks. Afghanistan has a long history of problems when elections are held. VOA Asia's Ira Melman talked about the situation there with Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Washington-based Wilson Center.
Unfortunately, in Afghanistan, there's always violence on election day, and certainly this time around was no exception. The Taliban had threatened to disrupt the elections, and there were quite a few reported attacks. And of course, as we know, in recent days, there was an assassination of General Razak, who was the most powerful figure in southern Afghanistan, and in response, Kabul decided to postpone voting for a week. So, you know, unfortunately, you had a lot of cases of violence. You also had cases of voters showing up at the polling station only to find that their names weren't on voting lists, or that there was just a lot of disorganization or even chaos at polling stations. And I think that's unfortunate, too. You have all these people that came out to vote. They braved Taliban threats, and yet they found that their governing authorities had not taken sufficient measures to allow them to vote. And that certainly is disconcerting.
What is your overall view of so many people turning out, and where does it go from here?
You know, let's remember that these elections, many people didn't expect them to happen at all. They had already been delayed twice, and the fact that they actually happened, I think that's a triumph. That's a victory for Afghanistan in of itself, and a defeat for the Taliban, which had vowed to disrupt them as much as possible and had told people not to vote in them. So that's a good thing. But certainly, you know, moving forward, I think that there's a lot of reason to be concerned about political stability in Afghanistan. I imagine that the many critics of the government in Kabul will use this, what will certainly be seen as a flawed election, as ammunition to escalate their criticism and pressure on the government in Kabul, which is already quite beleaguered and only a few months away from theoretically hosting a presidential election to see what the next top leadership in Afghanistan is going to look like. So it's going to be a pretty tense, I mean, as if things weren't already tense in Afghanistan, it's going to be a pretty tense few months, thanks in great part to these elections, which, you know, despite their happening, which is a good thing, will cause a lot of concerns and questions about legitimacy and credibility, which you know, all these critics of the government in Afghanistan will just jump on and apply constant pressure on this administration.
You said that over the weekend, the election caused a little setback for the Taliban. But what is the strength of the Taliban and other insurgent groups in Afghanistan now?
Well, I mean, let's be very clear that the Taliban now controls more territory in Afghanistan than at any time since 2001 when U.S. troops entered. So that's a pretty clear indicator of its strength. And also what's quite alarming, I mean, setting aside the territorial control issue, the Taliban basically has impunity. It can attack at will. It can attack whenever and wherever it wants. It stages attacks regularly in supposedly highly secure areas. Again, the most powerful man in southern Afghanistan, General Abdul Razak was assassinated, apparently by his own guards who were working for the Taliban. So I think it's all very sobering. We've been, or the U.S. forces have been in Afghanistan for 17 years. Initially the Taliban had areas of strength in the south, near the Pakistan border, but now it's got a pretty nationally entrenched presence, areas to the west and far to the north, where until relatively recent years it didn't really have much influence at all.
And what about other groups such as ISIS and even other groups such as China and Russia? Where do they fit into all this?
ISIS remains resilient. It continues to stage attacks. It doesn't have a huge number of fighters. The figures used to be in several thousands, now several hundred. But, you know, they're able to stage attacks, including in Kabul. And then you look at other players at the nation states. So very complicated state of affairs. The bottom line is that the war that the U.S. has tried to figure out a way to win in Afghanistan is not any closer to being won, while at the same time, some of America's top strategic rivals are making inroads in Afghanistan and deepening their footprint. So all in all, it's a bit of a mess.
The last few months in Afghanistan have been marred by election-related violence. 10 candidates have died in various attacks across the country, along with dozens of their supporters since the beginning of the nomination period in late May. The government has responded to the security concerns by deploying 70,000 security personnel around the country to safeguard 5,100 polling stations. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. 17 killed in Taiwan train derailment. China top official in Macau dies in fall from building. Australia government loses parliamentary majority. U.S. and South Korea again call off a major drill. Bali beauty pageant signals renewed anti-LGBT crackdown. Expanded coverage of these stories and more can be found on our Facebook page. That's VOA Asia, and also the VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Australia's centre-right government has lost its one-seat majority in Parliament following a defeat in a by-election in Sydney. The ballot was prompted by the removal of Malcolm Turnbull as Prime Minister in a party room coup. Phil Mercer tells us more from Sydney.
The defeat of the governing Liberal Party candidate is seen by analysts as an act of retribution by Sydney voters, furious at the way their former MP Malcolm Turnbull was ousted as Prime Minister. He was forced out by government colleagues in August, and he then resigned as an MP. For the first time ever, the seat of Wentworth isn't in Conservative hands. It'll be represented by Karen Phelps, a local doctor and prominent gay rights campaigner. She accused the government of ignoring voters and of doing too little to address the impact of climate change. She was given little chance of winning when the campaign began, but she's savouring her famous achievements.
People have been concerned about the direction of government for a very long time, and we've seen a lack of decency, a lack of integrity, and we really need to go back to looking at what the House of Representatives is all about. It's about representing the people, and the people have spoken loud and clear.
This is the biggest by-election swing against a federal government ever recorded in Australia. It strips the centre-right Prime Minister Scott Morrison of his narrow one-seat parliamentary majority in the lower house of Parliament. He accepts blame for the defeat, but says he will fight on.
The result today is on us, the Liberals. But leadership requires you to turn up on the tough days and the good days, and that's what you'll always get from me as the leader of the Liberal Party.
The Morrison government will probably survive for now with the support of independent MPs. But with a federal election due next May, its longer-term prospects appear grim. There is speculation that the government's grip on power is so tenuous that an early poll is considered in certain quarters to be inevitable. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening in Asia, China's top representative to Macau died late Saturday after falling from the building where he lived, according to the Chinese government. The Hong Kong and Macau office of the Chinese government state council said Zheng Xiaosong had been suffering from depression, but did not elaborate further on his death. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're starting off a brand new week, and we're glad you're with us on VOA Asia. A dissident Vietnamese blogger imprisoned for defaming the country's communist government is celebrating her first days of freedom on U.S. soil. VOA's Marcus Harten reports.
Nguyen Ngoc Nhu Quyen arrived in Houston early Thursday morning, accompanied by her two young children and her mother.
I'm still in shock, despite the fact that I had a little time to prepare myself mentally to unite with my family. I can't describe the feeling when my children hugged me on the airplane. We waited 2 years for this moment.
Quyen, who blogged under the pseudonym Mother Mushroom, wrote extensively about human rights and industrial pollution before she was arrested in October 2016 and sentenced to 10 years in prison.
They blocked all information and all contacts until the moment I was at the airport. That's why my son couldn't contain his feeling. Our reunion on board today is the message to the Vietnamese government that I'm not alone, and being a person with freedom of speech is not as lonely as they think.
Quyen said she came to the U.S. because no one cares more about human rights than the United States. She is among dozens of bloggers and activists who have been arrested since 2016 as part of the Vietnamese government's crackdown on dissent over the past 2 years. Marcus Harten, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, wood shapes new life in Pakistan. You're listening to VOA Asia. The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. This news from VOA Asia. At least 17 people were killed in a train derailment on a popular coastal route in Taiwan Sunday. Another 132 were injured, according to the Taiwan Railways Administration. All of the train's 8 carriages derailed. 5 of them were flipped over, according to the statement. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for this and many more stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, carpentry is traditionally considered a man's job in Pakistan, but a few brave women are changing that mindset. From carving unique wood and utensils to building an entire house, VOA spoke with several women who wanted to hammer home the point that not only are women integral to their community and the economy, they can also build things as well as the men. This report, produced in the remote Hunza Valley in northern Pakistan by VOA's Urdu service, tells their story. It's narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
My name is Amna. I am working as a carpenter. I am the master carpenter here. My friend Gulshan and I started this back in 2008, and now there are 43 women in our carpentry group.
The Agha Khan Development Network in Pakistan, a non-profit organization known for community development, started this project 10 years ago to make women more self-sufficient. And in a country where men are often the sole breadwinners, more than 100 women have now been trained to work in various fields, including carpentry.
It felt strange at first, holding a saw and other tools. It seemed very difficult, but once we got used to it, we liked it. We thought we would never leave this field. Soon after, many other women joined too.
Many of these women did not finish their education, but some have now become skilled carpenters. One told us she's supporting her family while doing what she loves.
My dad passed away a long time ago. I really wanted to get an education, but I did not have resources to complete it. I thought I should not only support myself, but my family too.
Carpentry is considered a man's work in Pakistan, and women are often discouraged from doing it.
At first, it was difficult for us to do this kind of job, given our societal mindset. It was not acceptable for a woman to do a man's job. People would say, why don't you learn sewing or knitting or become a teacher?
But Farman Bibi didn't want to sew or knit or teach. She had other plans. She's earning enough now to complete her education and still help her family.
We had many financial issues, which is the reason why I joined. Now I support the household and am completing my education. I helped my younger sister get her master's degree and helped my brother with his schooling.
In many countries around the world, women are already crucial contributors to a healthy economy. Despite the challenges they face, Aguila says it is time for Pakistani women to do the same.
Wherever women go, they face issues that will affect their honor, religion, culture, and social norms. However, when they step out and do something in order to take care of their family, then they realize that their honor, religion, culture, and everything is still in place.
Others say the biggest hurdle for women in Pakistan is the lack of freedom to make their own decisions.
Political and religious leaders often come to lecture us on what women should do. They never allow us the opportunity to think in terms of what we want as women.
Amna and her peers have become trailblazers in their own country. And they told VOA that they are determined and eager to help other Pakistani women understand that not only is it possible for a woman to be self-reliant, it's also good for the financial health of their families. For VOA's Urdu service, this is Bejan Hamdan, VOA News.
This news from VOA Asia. The pregnant Duchess of Sussex has had her schedule cut back during her first royal tour after a hectic start to her visit to Australia and the South Pacific with husband Prince Harry. Meghan, who is due to give birth in the spring, skipped an event in Sydney on Sunday morning. Relax and stay a while you visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the United States and dozens of other countries have pledged to work together to tackle the illegal wildlife trade and treat it as a serious crime following a conference in London. Trade in endangered wildlife, such as elephant tusks, rhino horns, and tiger bones, is worth an estimated $17 billion a year, and it's pushing hundreds of species to the brink of extinction. Henry Ridgewell reports on the recently held conference.
Training day for officers on the front line. Border guards and wildlife officials from Kenya and Tanzania are being taught to identify animal parts, which are often disguised or concealed in cargo or vehicles. All of these items were confiscated by the Kenya Wildlife Service. There's much work to do.
Only 50% of those that are convened here for this training this week could recognize elephant ivory. Only one of our 40 participants could recognize pangolin scales.
Such stark gaps in the global fight against the illegal wildlife trade were top of the agenda at the London conference. Speaking to several heads of state from across the world, Britain's Prince William, a passionate conservationist, said he recognized that law enforcement resources are already stretched.
But I am asking you to see the connections, to acknowledge that the steps you take to tackle illegal wildlife crime could make it easier to halt the shipments of guns and drugs passing through your borders.
It is an industry that is booming. Illegal ivory trade activity has more than doubled since 2007. Over 1,300 rhino were killed in 2015 alone. Asian tigers have seen a 95% decline in population. In the last year, more than 100 rangers have died in their line of work. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions said that Washington would give $90 million to programs that fight illegal wildlife traffickers.
Their criminal acts harm communities, degrade institutions, destabilize our environment, and funnel billions of dollars to those who perpetuate evil in the world.
It's not just big mammals at risk. Peruvian authorities say over 12,000 critically endangered frogs have been taken from Lake Titicaca in the last 5 years to make a juice that some believe has medicinal properties, despite no scientific evidence. But it's not all bad news. At the beginning of this year, China closed its domestic ivory market.
This market was both stimulating demand for ivory and also enabling illegal ivory to be laundered through this legal trade. But that same issue still exists for big cats. There's a trade in leopard bone products, large-scale commercial trade.
White says existing UN conventions already offer firepower for tackling the illegal wildlife trade, but they are not being used effectively. In the closing declaration, conference attendees pledged to work together to tackle the illegal wildlife trade as a serious and organised crime. Campaigners say the real test is how quickly they will act on those words. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News at the London Conference on the Illegal Wildlife Trade.
Scientists say the issue of climate change and global warming is becoming more pressing as news comes in about melting permafrost and rising sea levels. Scientists have been urging people across the globe to reduce emissions of climate warming carbon, but the Salk Institute in San Diego is taking a different approach. There, scientists are working on developing plants that would not only capture more carbon than plants do now, but also store it away for centuries, preventing it from being released back into the atmosphere. Jenia Dulo releases the rest of the story to us now.
In photosynthesis, plants use the energy in sunlight to absorb carbon dioxide from the air and combine it with water to create sugars to use for growth. In the process, they release oxygen and store the carbon in their tissues, including the roots. It's gradually released as the plants grow and when they die and decay. But some carbon stays in the soil. This inspired scientists from the Salk Institute in San Diego, California, to program plants to make more stable forms of carbon, which would be stored long-term deep in the soil.
When I was a child growing up in western Pennsylvania, I was an avid gardener. My grandmother and great-grandmother taught me to have a vegetable garden every summer. And I do remember from my childhood trying to put cork, because I knew it was a natural substance, like wood, but a slightly different form. I put it in my compost heaps and it never decayed.
Cork contains a high level of suberin, a waterproof waxy substance found in most plants that prevents roots from decomposing. It's this quality that scientists hope to use to keep carbon buried underground and, well, to save the world.
By leaving some plant carbon behind in the soil, the plants actually grow better. So an ecosystem or a farmer's field, etc., that has a higher carbon content in the soil is a healthier environment.
Today, scientists are working to create mechanisms that would allow plants to produce more suberin. Salk Institute labs imitate various climate zones to find a perfect plant for each region. This process takes time and energy. Recently, the Institute purchased a robot that in one day does more than a team of scientists can accomplish in 5 weeks. They're using conventional breeding to create crops that are carbon storage powerhouses, but may one day use genetic engineering.
We use the natural variation, the natural genetic variation that exists in natural strains to increase the amounts of suberin, so we are not necessarily in need to use genetic engineering. However, if we were to use genetic engineering, it would be much faster.
In the next 5 years, the scientists plan to have an array of plants for different regions that would help lower level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The effect wouldn't be felt for another decade or two, but the scientists say they hope by then humanity will have figured out how to slow down climate change. Jenny Adulo for VOA News, San Diego, California.
VOA Asia is the program you've been listening to. We invite you to come back and listen again tomorrow. You can find us on iTunes and SoundCloud. You can also find us streaming on VOA Asia Facebook as well as at our website, voanews.com. We also invite you to write to us. VOA Asia Facebook, a great way to get in touch with us, as well as our email, voaasia@voanews.com. We thank everyone who listened on the radio, the voice of Chung Rung, Star Radio FM 88.3 at Chung Rung Christian University in Tainan, Taiwan. Thanks for tuning in. Our thanks to go to director Tracy Carter, engineer Greg Burns, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a great day.